Hello and welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. So this is the second in our series really of sort of micro-credentialing, vaccination, community pharmacy type podcasts. Joined again by Derek Evans, all the way from Wales. And we're very, very lucky this morning to be joined by Professor Larry Goodyear, who I will introduce in a moment or two. So the series of podcasts is we're exploring the community pharmacy training arena. We're looking at, you know, we want to know how various stakeholders in pharmacy see the lie of the land. We're going to face into some of the challenges. You know, I think workforce at the moment is really, really tough. The operating platform of the community pharmacy network could be argued to be tough. And, you know, as was reported this week, the funding from our main customer, and I think we should call them a customer, the NHS, is flat at best. So it's in that sort of challenging context that we start a conversation with Professor Goodyear, and hopefully we'll find some, you know, positivity and some green shoots of hope really about where community pharmacy can go. I still believe in community pharmacy, always have. That's where my heart lies. But it needs work, in my opinion. It needs work and it needs investment. So without further ado, I don't want to bias the whole conversation by just trampling over it with my sort of thoughts and opinions. I'm going to introduce Professor Goodyear. So Professor Larry Goodyear is Professor of Pharmacy Practice at the School of Pharmacy at De Montfort University in the UK, of course. He worked as a clinical pharmacist through much of the 1980s and early 90s, and until 2003, he was head of pharmacy practice group at King's College London. His principal interest is within the field of travel medicine, in which he is keen to promote the role of pharmacists. Snap, so are we. He has lectured and taught widely on travel medicine to both health professionals and the public, and has been invited to address both national and international conferences on the subject, as well as appearances on television and radio, and of course, podcasts now. Related research interests include methods for bite avoidance and medical supplies for overseas travel. And finally, more broadly, in his capacity as Professor of Pharmacy Practice, he has been involved in research and teaching on a wide range of issues related to the profession of pharmacy. These include new roles for pharmacists, such as prescribing and medicines management. So as you can probably tell, listener, that's, you know, there's a lot of synergy with what we're trying to do, particularly around, you know, our micro-credentialing concept and enabling community pharmacists to not exploit's the wrong word, but build business models around prescribing practice and to do that, you know, as safely as we can and profitably, because if we don't do it profitably, then we won't exist. So good morning, Professor Goodyear. Whereabouts are you beaming in from this morning?
I live in Market Harbour, which is just outside of Leicester in the Midlands, East Midlands.
Lovely.
Pleased to be here today. Yeah.
And Derek, whereabouts are you beaming in for Wales again?
Yeah, I'm in South Wales, sort of in the southeast corner between the Esk and the Wye Valleys.
Excellent. And I'm up in rural Aberdeenshire and the sun is shining. So, Professor Goodyear, I suppose let's get going. A broad question to start. I always start my podcast like a consultation, really. Let's start broad with open questions and then see where we go. How do you see the lie of the community pharmacy land at the moment?
Well, I'm kind of most of my experience, just to kind of set the scene, really is in terms of what's happening in community pharmacy regarding vaccination services, immunisation services, and travel medicine. So that's kind of the, you know, the focus of my expertise. I have some view, of course, of what's going on in community pharmacy, but probably not as detailed as insightful as a practitioner who's working at the coalface, so to speak. So I am a essentially an academic. Having said that, though, in terms of the sort of the overall workforce situation outside of hospital pharmacy, of course, we recognise that the general practice pharmacist is a newly emerging branch, if you like, of the profession working, you know, within GP practices. And I think that is set to continue. Certainly, I see the undergraduates at Leicester, increasing numbers keen to explore that area of practice, which didn't exist before, of course, and probably drawing equally from those who might have been interested in hospital pharmacy and community pharmacy. So we have to recognise that shift, how large it will be in coming years, is a bit of an unknown, of course, but I think it will continue. So there's that shift in workforce and expertise. Still living, at least in the medium to longer term, the bulk of the workforce being in community pharmacy. So, you know, having said that, what are the sort of the challenges? I think we sort of you mentioned that the NHS was our main customer, and certainly on the supply side, that has been true, you know, and I think everyone recognises the diminishing returns from supply side activities by pharmacists in the community, and those, as you say, flat or may even reduce still further. And there's always been this sort of promise and indeed some activity in terms of the pharmacists themselves and their staff providing clinical services within community pharmacy. This, of course, started with the funded MURs and phased out to be new medication reviews and so on. Probably, and we can debate about that, but from what I've heard and talked, the returns from that in terms of sustaining a business model of an NHS contract for at least chronic disease management, perhaps, and you can, that's something we can discuss now, but my impression is that it's not really given at least the financial returns that it has, and it's actually been a little bit difficult in some cases to prove a clinical benefit, but we can, to the patient, but we can discuss that. I think there is benefit, but it's difficult to show in studies. So I think the first thing I would say is that we shouldn't necessarily give up, if you like, on providing the NHS with a clinic, not just a supply side service, with a clinical service. I think we need to continue to sort of fight that battle in terms of providing a properly remunerated chronic disease management service. I think that if more community, there's two things that really need to happen to do that. More community pharmacists engaging on independent prescribing. You may or may not be aware that the new MPharm standards, new undergraduate standards, incorporate prescribing within the curriculum more explicitly than it has. So we hope to get the pharmacists, looking forward 4 years, of course, ready, almost ready prescribers with a few things to do when they graduate. And the second thing that needs to happen is some kind of access to a common record, medical record for patients. With those two, I think their chronic services can develop. So that's my answer in terms of our relationship to the NHS. So, of course, there are a host of non-NHS clinical activities, and vaccinations is one, I guess, that I'll talk about the most, that certainly have a bright future for community pharmacy. So I'll stop there because I've rambled a little bit. Does that kind of answer your question?
It does. And it's unfortunately for you, it's triggered about 20 more. But that's the nature of it. Derek, I'll bring you in a minute or two. But I don't know. I think there's been, you know, it depends how there's two systems at play. You know, there's the stream of funding from the NHS, which is, you know, centrally decided, although, you know, in the four nations, there is some element of negotiation around what those services are and how they're deployed. I think one thing I would say, and I've always felt sort of not nervous, but I felt that it's not ideal that those services are all basically decided more or less. I mean, you could argue the toss, there's some that aren't, but more or less centrally. I think what I, you know, and it is an ideological view, I suppose, if it is an academic discussion, I think I would like to see a lot more localism introduced into the community pharmacy network. Now, unfortunately, with introducing localism and, you know, allowing the pharmacist that, you know, works in the local pharmacy, ideally, actually, I would like to see the local pharmacist own the local pharmacy, because they then will be invested in the community and understand, you know, what services are required. Very difficult to do that if you're following the money from the central pot. And I do recognise that it's a continuum. You know, you can't have everything being hyper-local. One of the things that multiple pharmacies do very well is standardise processes and work at scale to drive down cost. So there is an argument to government that you know, that community pharmacy just is not, you know, it's just not the cheapest, if we're looking at brass tacks, way to get a medicine to a drug or to a patient, sorry. Which brings me on to my next question, and Derek, I promise I will bring you in. You know, assuming, and this, the context of this is sort of, and we will come on to speak about services in a minute or two, but, you know, the context of this is that basically all the money has come from the NHS, more or less. But now in England, we've got this threat from online pharmacies, and they've really taken that supply side revenue stream and they've just drilled it down, haven't they? They've looked at the margins and they've just, you know, slashed the costs and worked at scale. And a lot of the companies that have come to notoriety in the market are just, from a business perspective, are just still burning money, you know, burning investment to get a foothold in the market. Coming back to the existing community pharmacy model, Professor Goodyear, assuming that it's not the cheapest way to get a medicine to a patient, in academic terms, do you think our application and practice around pharmaceutical care in real terms on the ground delivers enough value to justify selling that more expensive route to government?
I'm not sure I can really give a succinct answer to that. Because we're right in the middle of it, it's hard to see sort of the wood for the trees with our mix of services and where they're going. You know, these things are kind of not often academically researched, because it's hard to pinpoint underlying principles to the service delivery. Do you know what I mean? It's a kind of a mix of government policy, if you like, which changes, you know, it seems to me, of, you know, constantly depending on who's prime minister almost, and sort of the economic analysis of the most efficient method of delivery. So the, you know, these things shift, and it's very hard to pinpoint underlying academic principles to the best method of delivering a service. We look a lot, of course, at a clinical benefit to the patient, which is ultimately, you know, the other side of the, or the same side of the coin in terms of our business model. When we shift from supply side to giving clinical services, people look to us as academics and say, well, how do we prove that this is of benefit, whether or not it's cheaper? It might be more expensive to deliver a clinical service, or it might be cheaper than using the GP. Ultimately, though, you want to make sure that what the patient is receiving is giving them some kind of clinical outcome. And that's something that I have been researching off and on through most of my career, and it's extremely difficult to relate pharmacy service delivery to patient clinical outcome. A lot of debate around it, you know, we could talk for hours about the methods and shortcomings of the various work that has been done and what needs to be done in future. So that's the clinical side. Now, in terms of the business model, in terms of what is more efficient and cheaper, then it's quite likely that you know, the hub and spoke or the virtual pharmacy model is probably more sufficient in terms of simply supply. You know, I can't see how you could easily make an argument for anything else in terms of the supply side. But you lose clinical benefit probably when you do that, when you just turn out repeat medications and have no knowledge, particularly at least intimately, of the patient. You might lose clinical input, but proving, this is coming back to my original point, proving that loss of clinical input is detrimental to the patient is not easy and hasn't really been done. So yeah, there are a lot of academic considerations here, but we're all a bit in the realms of the unknown, I think.
Definitely, it's really interesting speaking to you, and I'm sure Derek has some questions. We'll come on to speak about maybe a bit more about, you know, your interest in travel vaccination services as mentioned, your interest in, you know, promoting pharmacists to do stuff above and beyond you know, dispensing, basically, in a moment. Derek, have you any thoughts or comments at this point?
I would really just like to explore some thinking that we know that the five-year degree will produce a wave of pharmacists newly qualified coming out as independent prescribers. So the first question would be really, what will experienced pharmacists feel and how will they manage who aren't independent prescribers when they've got an inexperienced pharmacist who is a prescriber, and how do we manage that interface? How will that be developing, I think? And then it's all about then the education of the independent prescriber. Now, currently, to be an independent prescriber, you need to have at least 2 years worth of experience of face-to-face patient management and experience before going on the course. Now, GPHC are now suggesting that this is removed and that anybody can become an IP. So I'd just like to explore, how do we prepare people as students who will be on the five-year course and then meeting face-to-face patients on day one as an independent prescriber? And how do we get them to manage the interface with experienced pharmacists who are not IPs?
I think if the community pharmacy is provide, and again we're looking at 5 years from now, if you to answer your questions, Derek, so looking a little bit into the crystal ball here, if we are at the stage in 5 years' time where the NHS is looking for community pharmacy to deliver a range of disease management type of services and other services that require prescribing, then I would suggest that the pharmacist who is practicing that time but hasn't gone through the new 5-year degree, which includes prescribing, themselves become prescribers. I can't see any argument, if you're going to provide that service, that you wouldn't be a prescriber. So I think that, you know, I would encourage all community pharmacists from this point onwards to consider prescribing courses, which of course done we're within the workplace pretty much. There's not a great deal of time out in terms of university attendance, at least to go on the register. So I think that that would be my answer. You know, if you're providing those services, doesn't matter how long you've been qualified, and you'd be prescribing, then you know you should be a prescriber yourself if you're providing services. The point about and something that we need to really sort out and consider is really the field of prescribing competence, which has always been a little bit vague, and this is probably coming on to the credentialising and the educational discussion that training discussion that you wanted to have, because the principle has been with independent prescribers that you must prescribe within your range of competence, and that has never really been very clearly defined. It's sort of the comeback is, well, it's up to you as the pharmacist, if you're asked, to prove that you're competent. So it's almost saying, well, if something goes wrong with your prescribing and you can't prove it's in your field of competence, then you're in trouble. And it always seemed to me that that wasn't very satisfactory. So when you go through the prescribing course, you have to have an area in which you demonstrate your prescribing. So, you know, you might be seeing patients, I think, with asthma, and you're being mentored. This is the current prescribing course, and usually often it's done through the GP practice, and you would be mentored by a GP, and you'd be looking for patients who had asthma, consulting with them, and then proving that you show your area of competence within prescribing of medication for asthma, and through that gain your prescribing qualification. And then the intention always was, well, if you move to another field, then you have to prove your competence in that field. And I don't think, and I think Derek, this is the point that Derek is making, that we actually provide very clearly, or even signpost clearly, what one might need to do in order to demonstrate a basic competence, and not at consultant level, but a basic competence in the area. And I think that's something that I think is leading on to the discussion we're having this morning.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's so few people in the profession, Professor Goodyear, that actually recognise that. I'm not being sort of offhand here or anything like that, but in my career, my greatest achievements at times have been getting to the stage of, you know, conscious incompetence, you know, and I've never understood the legals or the acceptability of independent prescribing in the pharmacist population being so open-ended. I can only speak to my own experience. I qualified as an IP and began trying to work and practice in community pharmacy. And, you know, I am a cautious soul when it comes to the clinical side of my life. And the result of me being, you know, sort of consciously incompetent with no, more or less, you know, I had my designated medical, supervisor for my prescribing course and so on, who was a local GP, but more or less I was unsupervised. So what that did to my practice was just really, really shrank down the scope. And the result, the net effect of that was really in year one of being an independent prescriber, like 90% of the prescriptions that I wrote were spacers for inhalers, you know, and that's one side of it. The other side of it is folk, you know, when I say folk, I mean pharmacists, absolutely going to town and, you know, starting services that are massively, massively risky, in my opinion. For example, you know, on the day, prescribing clinics in community pharmacy. And, you know, maybe I need to pick this up with the GPHC when I speak to Duncan Rudkin again for a follow-up interview. But, you know, I'm not, and it would be for him to answer, but I'm not convinced that the regulation of community pharmacy in that sphere is sufficient. Now, I never thought I'd be in a position to be asking for more regulation, but if it provides a fair playing field, then and of course a de-risked or safer playing field for patients to access our services, then I'd be all for it. And there's something around protecting the reputation of the profession as well. So I completely agree. Derek and I have come up with an abstract. Now, we're being a bit cheeky here because we're starting where we want to end up. But you know what? If you don't have a goal in mind, then it's tricky. And this is coming on to the conversation around, you know, prescribing, just what you said about a little bit about credentialing and so on and so forth. What I would say before I read this out is that the way I see credentialing is more or less inverted in comparison to how I believe others have tried to deploy credentialing in pharmacy. So rather than start right at the top with the cream of the crop, as it were, without being disparaging to all pharmacists, I want our micro-credentialing concept to be ubiquitously available and accessible. So that's why we're going to try and micro-credential a small number of tasks. So what we're going to do in the new year is take 60 independent prescribers through our first micro-credentialing process, really. And this is our abstract that we hope to publish. Now, it may, of course, change, but this will just set the scene for you, Professor Goodyear. So this review of 60 pharmacist independent prescribers looked at the introduction of a new professional service supplying private, we're choosing the private vaccination market for a number of reasons. There's standalone clinical areas, there are services that community pharmacists are well used to running. So for this first 60, we're going to take them through a pneumococcal vaccination micro-credential. Back to the abstract. So this service was to be introduced without the use of PGD and supplied by pharmacist independent prescribers only. In order to provide this service and comply with the regulatory body, GPHC, an amount of reskilling would be required for pharmacist independent prescribers without a defined competency in this field. Currently, this area of supply and design of new services is unregulated, well, we think unregulated, with pharmacy independent prescribers, and is a cause for concern. Now, what you've just said absolutely agrees with that. So that's really useful that we're on the same page. The use of micro-credentialing was considered as a principal method in allowing expanding of the competency of pharmacist independent prescribers to practice the new clinical areas. Micro-credentialing is defined as a qualification evidencing learning outcomes acquired through a short, transparently assessed course or module. Commercially, this would reduce the cost of having to purchase patient group directions from a supplier, increase the group of patients who could use the service by reducing exclusions, and increase the volume of prescribing offered by pharmacists. Now, there's a few statements there that need qualified. I will put the references in the show notes of the podcast. But Derek, I'll let you in a second or two. But Professor Goodyear, what's your sort of first impressions with our, you know, that's our destination about where we want to get to. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, just something to get in, because we're looking at the kind of the area of postgraduate training and so on. So just to step back a little bit from micro credentials, your concept, and then I'll say a few words about that as well. What I think that community pharmacists should be looking at is pretty soon after registration, embarking on one of the university-run postgraduate certificate diploma programs in clinical pharmacy, which is, you know, distance learn and, of course, validated and so on by at postgraduate level by the institutions. So I don't know what you feel about those, but I think if you are an independent prescriber and you're branching out into areas other than the one that you have initially qualified in, then undertaking that course of study for the couple of years usually takes post registration, just as doctors do, you know, just as you know, they do postgraduate studies for GPs to become members of Royal College and so on. I think that is pretty essential, I think, going forward for not, you know, De Montfort run the biggest one, so I'm not putting in a plug in there, but you know, it's
feel free.
I think it's so, you know, it runs alongside what you're talking about, but I think it's in terms of a basis for future clinical practice, I think it's important. Coming on now to the this question of the regulation of our clinical services, my impression is that I tend to agree with you. I think the GPHC, the model previously, has been one of, you know, inspection and regulation around supply side very much. We should really be regulated by more on the principles that the CQC use for all that, all the issues that raises, and providing these services, vaccination services, you know, all various hands-on services. I think I'm probably right in that we're one of the few professions that are not directly under the auspices of the CQC. It's been a long-running debate that hasn't yet resolved. So I'll be interested to see what you think. But yeah, I think and see what the GPHC has to say at this present time. But you know, the time is coming when we need to look at a more clinically based regulator than maybe we have at the moment. In terms of the micro side, then, just coming on directly to your abstract, I think there's a balance here between credentializing individual vaccines like the pneumococcal vaccine or something, you know, something you're prescribing, a drug entity you're prescribing, as opposed to credentializing, and I would probably look at it as something that was more all-encompassing. So you're perhaps credentializing the administration of groups of vaccines, maybe. So you're credentializing adult vaccination and then all of them within that. That includes the travel vaccinations, and we have special things for, you know, fever, for instance. Or you're credentializing childhood vaccination, you know, which will probably come at some point. You're credentializing travel health services, but not at a consult, you know, specialist level, at a basic level. Do you see what I'm getting at? Oh, you're credentializing the management of hypertension, not the individual drugs. Now, that might fall outside of your micro concept, I don't know, but that would seem to be more efficient than individual vaccines to me, for instance.
Absolutely. And yeah, no, that's really good feedback. And I suppose I went for a single topic, single condition, probably just to standardize as many variables as I could. That was the thinking behind you know, going for one. So but I do agree with you. Yeah.
Principles of a study than a service, a real service model. But just
Derek?
Yeah, very interesting. It's very similar to my thoughts and feelings there, Larry, and I expect you would think that. One of the things I'd like to explore is how we can use micro-credentialising to move an independent prescriber who maybe have got his competency in, say, cardiovascular, for example, but then decides he wants to move to do travel medicine as well, because I regularly, routinely see somebody who works a standard job, and then at the weekend decides he's going to run a private vaccination clinic, starts writing prescriptions for typhoid vaccine and hepatitis vaccines, etc., etc., but has had no formal training. So it was the use of the micro-credentialising process to help build competencies. And I know you've done some work, and certainly when I was working with you, on the therapeutic framework. So I wonder if you could expand a bit on that.
It allowed the person to build up knowledge behind their prescribing. So it was a simple template of the areas that you had to consider. And then going forward, you could show that you had devised your own therapeutic framework when you shifted into another area. So you could incorporate that in terms of your sort of credentializing in a particular field, or people could use it individually as a sort of to improve their or demonstrate their competence. So yes, that is one way of doing it. I think with credentializing, I suppose a couple of things to consider is that if it's private, then it has to be sort of regulated or approved in some way by somebody. And I'd be interested in your thoughts about that. The GPHC themselves obviously are not interested in that sort of thing. The RPS had a go at it a few years ago, but I've kind of lost sight of really what happened to their credentialising process, but it was really more to build people up into or to improve the level of practice to consultant level. So it was a kind of a different thing. It was involved with membership of the faculty of the RPS. So it's really how we're going to approve, what body might approve or have a view on the credentialising program that you devise. And I've forgotten, Derek, what was your original question? What else
How we use the micro-credentialising process to take somebody from one therapeutic competency group to another one. So how do they bolt on the additional therapeutic groups so that they are a prescriber that has a uniformity of standards of education and knowledge in each?
I think as coming back to my point, an underlying qualification in clinical pharmacy, I think, is probably the bedrock. Probably it's having been credentialized in fairly broad areas that are important, and in some cases it's linking in to what can currently be done. So with travel medicine, there is a practice framework, the Faculty of Travel Medicine that Derek and I belong to in the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Glasgow, that is multi-professional, has devised certain standards of practice. We probably need to look within the faculty at people operating not at a specialist level, but a more a generalist level. So it's working with them, devising and looking for that. You can take a diploma and other things in travel medicine or a certificate in travel medicine practice now. But for people who want relatively short programs, then that there is probably a gap. But I think you've got to look at what is there, what's needed, how it can be done efficiently, and who regulates, if you like, recognises the qualification.
It's a real interesting one, actually. I take your point about doing a university-led clinical diploma and so on and so forth. I think that's in an ideal world that would be perfect. But I suppose to sort of set the context of where I'm coming from with this idea is that the reality is there's not a huge incentive for community pharmacists to do that. I mean, obviously, if it was fully funded and they were released to do it, I bet loads of them would take it up. But in reality, it's just not the case. That said, I do strongly agree with you that that's the best route. In terms of regulating, I mean, I'm sorry to be blunt, but as far as I can see, and let's argue the toss about this, I don't see many standards at the moment in community pharmacy clinical services. What I see in the market is patient group directions. I see community pharmacists signing up to them, engaging in more or less a box ticking exercise where they, in effect, outsource the clinical reasoning, the clinical decision making to someone, a practitioner that's not there, i.e. the person that's written the PGD. And that's how we deliver clinical services in the travel and vaccination scene. Anyway, would you agree with that sort of doom and gloom sort of look at the market, Laurie?
I do. I mean, I think, a lot of the trade, particularly in travel medicine, the pharmacists rely on the PGD suppliers for their education. Now, in theory, I'm not entirely sure that it's the case, is the person providing the PGD is regulated by the CQC. So that is their regulator. And in theory, at least, the CQC then say, well, you're providing these are the PGDs you've used. You're responsible as the PGD provider for the people who are using your PGDs. And therefore, you have to give them education and training and audit what they're doing. Okay. So that's kind of sounds, isn't it? That the pharmacists are. That they are being provided training by a regulated body. Do you see the theory behind it? I can't say that is or isn't the case, but my impression is that the training isn't as regulated. It certainly seems that providers give different levels of different types of training, different levels of training. So I don't know, and Derek's got probably more experience with this than I have because he works with the PGD suppliers to some extent. Is that true, Derek? Is the CQC, does it have a grip on what these people are doing and regulate them? Because they are registered with CQC.
Yeah, these people are registered with CQC because with the PGD you need to have a sign off by a doctor, and of course the medical profession come under CQC, whereas the pharmacists don't. Not at the moment. So what we find is we find that the CQC know about this, but the CQC are quite heavily worked in inspection and regulation of suppliers, that this doesn't really come particularly high in their list of priorities, unless of course there's an intervention needs to be made following a subsequent clinical reaction. The point which I'm always making, there are three elements that somebody really needs to consider for their competency. One is the knowledge of the clinical disease or condition that they are treating. Secondly, it's about are there practical skills for that? Is there anaphylaxis training, their technique on vaccination, their basic life skills, are these up to date? And we know that these are formally reviewed and assessed, and there is a requirement to do that. And thirdly is about assessment. A lot of places allow self-assessment. Well, we know from studies, and certainly there are a lot of inferences from the medical profession, that self-assessment is not necessarily the best form of assessment of an advanced skill, and it should really be done by a third party, by an external group. So I feel really for, if we're talking advanced services, we need to be talking the knowledge, which is above and beyond what people learnt as an undergraduate, and certainly in infectious diseases, you can't teach everything in the undergraduate syllabus that you would necessarily need to know, say, at travel medicine level. And then taking that forward is putting it into concept with the other two elements. One is, should assessment be only external? Should we allow any self-assessment? And likewise, we have assessment standards for the practical vaccination techniques and things such as the BLS and anaphylaxis. So why do we not assess similarly the knowledge area as well? I just wondered what your thoughts were about that.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to pick up a model that assesses and regulates every clinical activity that might be required going forward. I think just simply on the level of the vaccination services, and let's just take vaccination services in travel medicine, which is something I know a bit about. It's quite likely that the PGD providers give a reasonable service in terms of the mechanics of administering the vaccine and screening out people who should be referred or should not receive the vaccine by using the PGD. So I think kind of that's a reasonable, they probably do that reasonably well. I that's my impression. What's not so developed is how to conduct a travel medicine consultation, for a wide range of people who are traveling in different circumstances and so on. So there you're looking at a service rather than a PGD activity. And I think as these services emerge, so we should be looking at who is best to provide, if it exists, the standards and also the training to deliver at least the basic safe service. As I say, for travel medicine, that's likely, I hope, to reside in the Faculty of Travel Medicine, and we can use that in order to credentialise people. But I think there's work to be done in making sure that it can be done easily and efficiently for a large number of pharmacists who want to do it. The RCN, for instance, provides their own framework and so on for nurses. The difference, though, the big difference, and the one that we have to really grapple with in community pharmacy, is that everyone else is working in GP practices, essentially, with all the support of a team of people. Pharmacists are working independently, and I think there's going to be a lot to be gained by devising methods of enabling pharmacists to shadow, mentored, whatever it is, by a person who is prescribing in that field as part of the credentialising service activity. And I think that is going to be the key to providing over and above, you know, actual training and improving knowledge, it's devising methods whereby you know, pharmacists can shadow someone else, and that mentoring shadowing activity is remunerated, I guess, as part of it. So I think that's probably key, and that's the way that everyone else in the GP sector, you know, in the practice, gains their experience, gains their competence, is by working with the people doing the job. We don't have that luxury to the same extent, and I think the way forward is to try and devise systems that do allow for that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there, Larry. And that was the game changer in my, you know, I'm N equals one person, of course, but that really was the game changer in my career. Once I got into a multidisciplinary team, I just found it such a, I really did find it such a professionally enriching experience. And my, you know, going from running a community pharmacy for a large company for 8 or 9 years to suddenly being enveloped within a GP nurse, you know, advanced nurse practitioner, all sorts, OTs, or, you know, the multidisciplinary team environment was really, really exciting. And that's where, you know, to get to the nub of the thing, that's what I would love, or what we would love to develop. It's the boring infrastructure, you know. And to your point about the Faculty of Travel Health, Medicine and so on, I mean, don't take this the wrong way, but it's a classic case of that what the faculty does is absolutely brilliant. There's no question about that. But if you look at it from, you know, just business principles, and this is the problem, this is the sort of businessy chasm or practice chasm we need to get across. It's their competence framework for, let's say, travel medicine is fixing a problem that no one cares about. And because we're stuck in this, in community pharmacy I'm talking about here, we're stuck in this vortex of the use of PGD. So, I mean, there's a question for you. Do you think PGDs in the long run are holding community pharmacists back?
Yeah, I think that's probably a reasonable comment to make. I think, you know, it's an interim, it's a stepping stone, but I think, yeah, we will be looking at people becoming prescribers, you know, because of the new 5 degree. So, I think we need to move away. And I don't necessarily disagree with what you say about the, you know, the standards as produced by faculty and so on. I think people who are going to want to say that they, you know, they provide an expert service in travel medicine, definitely need, you know, that kind of qualification, if you like, and backing. I still think there's work to be done in basic competency to provide a safe basic service within limits, you know. But I think if we end this podcast on anything, and we're coming to the hour, so I guess we're coming there, is that you're quite right. It's the experience of working in a multi-professional team in your certainly in your formative years and as you shift areas of practice, that's going to be the key. You know, this is the way hospital pharmacy has developed, obviously quite easily because, you know, that's the environment. It's probably going to be the way that GP pharmacists develop, obviously, you know, so working in that same team. And community pharmacists have got to grapple with, including the multiples, we all have to grapple with that basic element that's missing from our training. It's improving competence by working within the multi-professional team, hands-on, day-to-day, and how we compensate for that and allow for that. I don't have massive answers, but, you know, that's maybe another podcast. What are the ways that we can can shadow each other and mentor each other efficiently? It's going to be a good one.
Yeah, Jeff. I mean, yeah. Let's finish it there. I mean, I think it's testament to how interested we all are in the topic and the It feels like we've been speaking for 5 minutes, but of course an hour has passed. So yeah, let's draw it to a close. But yeah, if we ever speak again, we must find topics that we disagree on, because there's been a bit too much agreement here. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, no, I don't think from what we've been saying, you know, that there is, I think if you talk to most practitioners, I think they'll probably agree with what we've been saying, you know. It's how to fix it is the big thing. What's going to work is the issue.
I agree, and unfortunately, some folk are reticent to talk about money and investment and so on and so forth. But if we're going to create the infrastructure and, you know, concepts like community pharmacy training practices, for example, that needs money, and that needs a business model, and it needs viable businesses, at the, you know, business propositions and services at the front end. And that's, you know, that's to an extent we've got an, you know, I've got an eye on that as well, and I'd be very upfront and honest about that, but no idea whether we'll get there.
Who have that potential infrastructure, of course, the large multiples, you know, and you can perhaps enter with a conversation with them about setting up training practices. Obviously, it will be for their own pharmacists, but they might, you know, there'll be all the commercial pressures of, yeah, that's a good idea for our own pharmacists, but, you know, we don't want anyone else to benefit from it, you know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, so, definitely. That's the whole other topic as well, the fragmented nature of the community pharmacy market. But I'm going to, going to cut, because it's been absolutely brilliant speaking to you. And Derek, thank you ever so much as well, Derek, for coming on, and some very insightful comments from you, Derek, as well, as usual. And Larry, thank you very much for your time. I know I didn't expect it to go on for so long, but I was really enjoying it. So thank you very much.
So it's good, you know, in this pandemic, you know, it's nice to chat, isn't it? You know, we don't get together very often now.
Absolutely. And I know we agreed quite a lot, but I think sometimes these things need said. I think there's a lot of negativity in community pharmacy, rightly so, because it's really tough out there, but people need a bit of a reason to believe, you know, so hopefully we can nurture
it. There's a way forward, and hopefully we'll find it. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay. All the best, Derek. All the best, Larry.
All the best. See you.